You're listening to a Why Now podcast.
This is the Worldwide Will Show on whynow.co.uk. I'm your host, Will. I'm a British Army veteran of just short of 11 years and served numerous tours of Afghanistan. In this show, I'll be speaking to former members of the British Armed Forces and Coalition Forces, giving them a platform of which to tell their life story, as well as experiences and how it's affected them. I hope you enjoy the show. Welcome to the Worldwide Will Show with me, Will, and I'm joined by...
Tyrone Coronel.
Yes, sir, all the way from America.
Yeah, you know it, South Florida.
South Florida. We're actually off to Florida next year, so we'll have to hook up for a barbecue or something when we're down.
You gotta come to the house. Stay at my casa. We eat a lot of food and drink a lot of beer.
Sounds good to me. I think even Stefan, who was on the podcast earlier, he was talking about trying to come down as well. So it'd be good for all three of us to have a barbecue.
There's plenty of space over here at my casa, so we'll definitely do it big.
Perfect, perfect. So, as you guys all know, this podcast is about telling people stories. I believe that everyone's life is a story, and everyone should have the chance to tell that story for themselves. So here we are with Tyrone. Tyrone, kick it off, bro. Where did it all start?
All right, man. Like, for example, for me, as you know, I was born in a city called Cartagena, Colombia, you know, South America.
Si?
Extremely si? Poor. See. So yeah, I mean, like the little house where I grew up, we lived on the edge of a canal. There was like no tile floor. There was no electricity, no running water. It was just pretty much like a wooden shack.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I grew up there with my grandma, my cousins, my mom, and you know, my grandma was a baker, so she used to bring some bread, and you know, very poor, very poor.
Was the country poor as a whole back then?
In some parts, yes. I mean, remember, I grew up in the era where, you know, the narcos and the cartels were, you know, bombing the country. Escobar was just running wild.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And, you know, there was a lot of cartel. Not as close, obviously, where I live, because I lived on the coast.
Mm-hmm.
But towards, like, Cota, Medellin, shit was just wild.
Yeah, yeah.
Bombings, shootings. You know, airplanes were being, blown up in the middle of the air.
Bandit country.
So it was crazy. Yeah, exactly. So where I lived, I mean, there was a lot of poverty, but there was also a lot of areas where, you know, it was wealthy.
Uh-huh.
Because I grew up in a beach town. So you had a lot of contrast, you know, between, you know, like poverty and real rich.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
You know, unfortunately, I grew up really poor, but you know what? That hardened me up.
100%.
Who I am today.
Yeah.
So when I was 8 years old, my mom was able to immigrate to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she moved to the U.S. And then 4 years later, she was finally established here, you know, with the language, working. And I was able to come to the U.S. July 4th, 1993. I was 12 years old. From that point forward, you know, I pretty much just went to middle school, went to high school.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like, just to give you a little bit of a backstory, like, one of the first things that my mom said when I got to the U.S., she was like, you have 2 years to learn English.
Mm-hmm.
That's one.
Mm-hmm.
Two, if you ever get in trouble with the law, like, don't call me because I'm not going to come get you out.
Yeah.
And she goes, if you ever get in trouble, like, as soon as you're out, you're going to find yourself on a one-way ticket back to Colombia and you're never coming back.
Yeah.
So that in itself, I mean, as a single mother raising a young rebellious knucklehead, that put the fear in me to mm-hmm. not get in trouble, you know, mm-hmm. because, you know, as you know, as being, you know, young boys, we want to be rebellious.
Sure,
we
yeah.
You know, wild.
You push boundaries. Yeah.
So mom was like, I ain't putting up with your shit. You know, she was like, I put it up. You screw up and you're gone.
Yeah.
So that kept me away from, you know, getting into gangs or drugs or trouble. You know, I tried to join the army as soon as I got out of high school. And I couldn't because I still didn't have my green card yet.
Yeah.
I was in the process. I even went to the recruiter. I was like, hey, you know, like what you can do for me. But at the time, there was no war going on. The recruiter was like, nah, you just got to wait your time. So I pretty much fucked around for 4 years, party, work, whatever. September 11th happened. You know, and my paperwork for my green card was a lot faster, but I didn't have the card yet. So I was like, you know what? I feel like I need to do something for the country that has given me so much.
Yeah.
So I went to the Marine recruiter because a few buddies of mine were already Marines. I went to the Marine recruiter. I was like, hey, I have this situation. I'm willing to, you know, sign up if you help me out. And within 2 weeks, I had a letter saying, hey, come over here to the Marine recruiter with your paperwork. They gathered all my paperwork. They sent the letter to Immigration and Naturalization Services, signed saying that I was willing to join the armed forces if my paperwork was expedited. I had my green card within 30 days.
Wow.
I'm talking about appointment, paperwork, full green card, like full papers, ready to join the military. Because at the time, I mean, they needed bodies to go in the infantry.
Well, so it was almost like a draft. It was like the demand was there.
Exactly. It was almost like, hey, it was like, it's not mandatory, but screw it. Like, even people with, like, some type of criminal records were being waived to join, you know? Because we knew, I mean, I guess the government knew that it was going to be, you know, something crazy in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And they needed guys in boots, so right?
They needed boots on the ground. So I joined, you know, deployed to Iraq a couple of times. I got banged up over there a couple of times. In the last 2 years, I went actually to train at the Marine base, same place where I went to boot camp in Paris Island. So I became a coach and, you know, a range instructor to teach marksmanship and shooting and martial arts and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Then obviously for me, I wanted to go to school. I was a little bit older, I was a little bit more mature, but being in the infantry, as you know, there's no time to go to school.
No.
You're training somewhere, you're deployed somewhere, or you're sleeping and eating because, I mean, you're not going to dedicate time to school when you do a workup months at a time or weeks training here and there.
Yeah.
So I was like, you know what, I'm going to get out. But when I get out, I mean, I lost friends, as you did as well. I lost brothers in Iraq and Afghanistan. I was so effing bitter that I knew I needed to work, but I didn't want to work at an office. So I became a trucker. So there I was.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, man, I became a trucker. I put my ball cap on and I was driving from Florida to California to Tennessee, Georgia, Carolinas. I mean, Texas, you know, Arizona, all over the place. So, because my boss literally was my computer, the computer I had in my truck. I got a mission, hey, go pick up this load somewhere and go take it somewhere. Dang, that's what I did.
Easy, yeah.
But it got to a point where I was like, this shit is just not for me. You know, I came back to the house, I moved in with my mom, and once again, she was like, do not become a statistic. I don't want you to be, you know, sitting on this house, you know, staying up to 3 in the morning, watching TV, doing nothing. It's like, you're either going to work or you're going to go to school. So I got a job with a company called Walking Hunt, and I became a, you know, a bullshit security officer. Guess what? I applied for TSA. Months after, I got a letter saying, sorry, you do not meet the qualifications for TSA. And I said, what? I got a freaking security clearance, 2 combat deployments. I mean, like, all kinds of shit, and I don't qualify for TSA. And I was like, I see the quality people that TSA has working at the airports.
Just for the listeners, what does TSA stand for, and what is it?
It's pretty much the air security. Pretty much the people who are checking or doing the security before you get inside the airport. You know, it's the Transportation Security Administration. That's what it stands for.
Yeah.
But it's pretty much the bomb security guard at the airport that up to this day, some don't even know what a tourniquet is.
Yeah.
Some don't even know what an AED is.
And I bet they're fucking assholes as well.
Yes, amongst many other things. So, you know, I got a job living at my mom's house. I was working full-time from midnight to 8 a.m. I would sleep, you know, from like 8 or 9 a.m. to like, you know, 3 or whatever. I wake up, go to school. I wake up, go to the gym, and then I would go to school full time from 6 p.m. to like 10:30 p.m.
Shit.
So that was pretty much my life: going to school full time, work full time. But I was going to EMT school, you know, because I'm either going to be a law enforcement officer or I'm going to be a firefighter.
Yeah.
And I was like, nobody's happy to see a freaking cop come to somewhere. Everybody is hating a cop.
Yeah.
And everybody's happy to see a fireman come in.
Sure.
You know, that's just, you know, that's just how it is. So it's like, I'm going to go to the fire department. I like the hours. I like the team environment, blah, blah, blah. So I went to fire school, went to EMT school, did everything. And when I was, going through the hiring process on the fire department, I put an application in for Blackwater. And they were like, hey, you got a clean record. You don't have any, any history with back credit. You already got a security clearance from DOD, Department of Defense. And you're an EMT. They were like, are you interested to go to an EMT Intermediate 99 course in Virginia? I'm like, sure.
Yeah.
So I went, I passed that, and they were like, are you interested to go to WPPS, which is Worldwide Personal Protection Services? It's pretty much diplomatic security.
Is that the WIPS? Like, sure. WIPS contract?
Yeah, that's WIPS. Yeah. Yeah, exactly, WIPS. State Department and WIPS contract. So they offered me that, and I'm like, sure. We graduated on a Friday.
Mm-hmm.
Friday evening, they were like, go pack your shit. You're deploying to Iraq tomorrow.
Fuck.
And I'm like, I got a mail shit at home. I'm like, they were like, you better wake up early and be there by the time the post office opens because you're leaving.
Yeah.
Like at noon, we're taking you to the airport.
Fuck.
And I was like, all right. So I was at the mailbox at 8 a.m. And at noon, I was on a plane from North Carolina to D.C., Amman Jordan, Amman Jordan, direct to Baghdad.
Fucking
hell. Literally within 72 hours after I graduated WIPS, I was in Baghdad. After that, I was in Iraq for a while. Blackwater lost the contract. Triple Canopy took over. I stayed over.
Uh-huh.
And then after that, I was like, I need a break from this shit. I've been in Iraq too long. Came back to the house, put myself through school, went to paramedic school, got my associate's degree on EMS, Emergency Medical Services, and then went into global.
Yeah, man.
On the contract where you and I met.
Yeah.
So that's pretty much, I did global into like 2 months before it shut down, because I came back about 2 months before it shut down.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was pretty much my rotations in Iraq and Afghanistan or, Pakistan, Syria, whatever. So after that, I went to work actually for State Department as a teacher C instructor on a mission called INL, International Narcotics and Law Enforcement.
Oh, cool.
And what we pretty much do is just teach special forces in Latin America. So State Department has, a lot of money, millions, hundreds of millions of dollars that we give to countries in Latin America with police and armies.
Yeah.
But obviously any money that comes from us, like, they have to agree that they're going to use, that we are going to train their people.
Yeah.
Which is, it's a document they sign. And so they train people like me that can speak the language to go train, Mexican, and Colombia, and Guatemala, Honduras. That's pretty much what I've been doing since 2014, on and off.
Awesome.
Training back. And obviously just doing security work. Just, clients, they know my background. They know what I can and what I can't do.
Mm-hmm.
So as an independent contractor, I've been doing a lot of work in Latin America, some in Europe, but mostly, from Mexico all the way down. And as you know, Mexico is turning into a shit show.
Yeah.
With the cartels running around, shooting up town.
Anti-aircraft guns and
just
RPGs.
It's just Wild West.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Yeah.
So that's
pretty much it with the work, Just here at home, family, wife, kid, happy, can't complain.
So just for the listeners, Tyrone and I go back to what, 2013, 14.
Yeah.
So we were on a team together, working in Afghanistan, in a little area called, I'll just regionalize it, but Jalalabad, Yeah, we worked on the team together. He was the paramedic on the team. I was one of the team members. In fact, I think we lived right next door to each other, didn't we?
We sure did.
Yeah.
We share a freaking Connex with just a divider in the middle.
That's it. Just a small stud wall between us.
Pretty much. I could hear Will farting around all night long.
Yeah, we won't go into what we heard each other do. But, yeah, it was good times. It was good times. I always compare myself. So, have you seen the film Napoleon Dynamite?
Yep.
You know the weird Uncle Rico who talks about the state championship. So I talk about global like he talks about we could have won state, man. I always talk about that global contract. Like it's the best time of my life that year was
it was good times, man.
The best job I've ever had.
We had a good team.
Yeah.
We had a good team. And honestly, I think I told Shram this a couple times that, you know, on all the teams that I was in, he was pretty much, you know, the only, you know, without saying much, the only one that would tell the client, fuck off, we're not doing that.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. 100%.
But it was good, man. We had a good team, you know, good time. Good
yeah, we had a good, strong team, which was good. You know,
very much. That's right.
You know, it was funny because the replacement paramedics would just be like, "Oh, he's nothing like Tyrone, is he?" He's like, "Nah." So we had, you know, I mean, God rest his soul. The guy who passed away, he was from New York, Detroit, New York, and he claimed himself to be Irish. Like most people from fucking New York
yeah,
do.
That was not
no. Good. So he was like, "Oh yeah, I'm Irish." And I looked at OB and I was like, "Oh, he's Irish." I like nodded. And OB was like, "Whereabouts in Ireland are you from?" He's like, "Oh, well, my grandparents are Irish." And I was like, "Oh yeah, forgot about the big fuck off bridge that went from Ireland to America." But
I'm glad, you know, like one of the things that I'm definitely grateful for that, you know, our teams, you know, always stuck together, you know, good and bad. We were always strong and we were always there for each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, no drama, no bullshit. There was no animosity. It was like, hey, we got a mission. Let's go make it happen and let's get back inside the fob safe and in one piece. You know, so I'm definitely very grateful for that.
Yeah.
For that team cohesion that we had.
Yeah, very professional, good team, worked together. And then when we were back in camp, we just fucked around like fucking kids, which was you know
it,
that's what you got to do.
Yeah, that's it, man.
So
team, work out.
Whilst you were in the Marine Corps, how many tours of Iraq did you do?
I did two tours to Iraq, so pretty much like we went into Kuwait, and it was, I believe, the end of January in 2003, and then we set up camp in the middle of nowhere, and then pretty much about a month and a week after that, you know, at the beginning of March or mid-March, something like that, we literally packed all of our shit and started pushing up north.
Yeah.
We crossed the LOD, I believe it was March 19th. Then we crossed the line of departure between Kuwait and Iraq. And within 4 to 5 hours after we crossed the LOD, it was like all hell broke loose.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it was just nuts. It was burning oil field. It was just shit everywhere.
So it's pretty much burning, like, is it the program or the film Jarhead? Was it much like that?
We were pretty much right behind first recon.
Right.
So it was first recon going, you know, north, like northwest. And it was 1st Battalion, 7th Marines. And then I believe it was 2nd recon, you know, that they, like going northeast.
Yeah.
And it was 1-2. So it was recon battalions up front, and there was, you know, 1-7 on the west and 1-2 on the east. So we were pretty much going along the same route, and then we split. March 23rd, we split. You know, we went west a little more. 1-2 kept going east and north.
Yeah.
And that's when those two A-10s got mowed down by, I mean, those two AAVs, three AAVs, got mowed down by the A-10s.
Yeah.
So March 23rd, 2003, you know, 18, 19 Marines,
fuck,
you know, perished due to friendly fire.
Yeah, it's, I mean, like friendly fly, you can't even like comprehend, or you can't even explain it. It's just,
I mean, like at least for us, I mean, like the A-10 flies closer to the ground than any other jet. And the size of the orange markers that we had on all of our vehicles, I mean, you can see that shit from freaking, you know, 25 miles up. So how did they didn't see those orange markers? You know, it was just crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, and then pushing up, you know, we got lit up by 3rd LAR.
Yeah.
You know, from west to east, and we were going south to north, and we got lit up, and we all had to jump up at a shit trench.
Yeah.
So there was obviously a big AO, a lot of miscommunication,
luckily
for us. I mean, we were low to the ground, but, you know, when the LA art opened up, I mean, we thought we were going to die.
Yeah, 100%. I think there's a lot of lessons learned from the early years in Iraq and early years of Afghanistan in terms of like fratricide and friendly forces, blue and blue. There's, I mean, for the good, but unfortunately, a lot of guys lost their lives in learning those lessons. Yeah. You know.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we like I said, it is, you know, it happens here and there, but not to the magnitude that it happened.
Sure.
When you had, you know, 30,000 troops going up, and it was just like all out brawl.
Yeah.
And I believe one of the downfalls, like at least for us, trying to reach the objective so fast, mm-hmm. that like forgetting that, hey, at the end of the day, we still need support from like logistical support.
Yeah, yeah.
We're still gonna need fuel. We still need water. We still need ammo. So if the infantry battalions are pushing up so fast, you know, eventually you're gonna run out of food,
yeah.
and out of ammo and out of water. Okay, the rest of the train is freaking 3 days away.
Yeah. Well, you isolate yourself if you go too fast, right? It's isolated.
Exactly. So we were isolating ourselves and, mm-hmm. you know, finding ourselves alone. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously we did have air support, but at the end of the day, there's a lot of lessons to be learned on, hey, how can we push this mm-hmm. as fast as we can, mm-hmm. but at the same time, going as together as we can.
Yeah. I think that's... Yeah. That's a lesson we took into Afghanistan. I mean, there was a lot of silly mistakes made in Afghan in the early years. Like, we underestimated the amount of Taliban fighters there were in relation to how many guys we put on the ground. But we definitely learned from Iraq not to push too fast, so we couldn't sustain ourselves. So, like, we slowly crept. Even though on my first tour, we were in Gom Seir, we were an hour away by Hilo from Camp Bastion, from the resupply, and half the time Hilos couldn't get there because it was that dangerous to land. So we did find ourselves running out of food, water. We had to repurify the canal water, and we were running out of ammo, which is the more scary part of it.
And another thing that we also have to take into consideration on both AOs, like, yeah, so okay, so those are things that we can prevent by obviously slowing down, but we cannot prevent the weather. We mm-hmm, cannot prevent mm-hmm. a big ass freaking sandstorm that lasts an mm-hmm. entire day. Mm-hmm. And then look, okay, so now we can come south. Support can go up north.
Yeah.
Helos can fly. Fast movers can fly.
Yeah.
So, and then we find ourselves into a 3 day, you know, weather condition that, you know, what do we do?
Not only that, so like that sort of those sort of weather storms or the sandstorms gives perfect cover for insurgents to move. It's their background. It's their land. They know.
Exactly.
They know where to
they
go.
Know.
So it's a perfect. It's almost like a massive smoke screen. They'll just move in it.
Yeah. Like, I'll give you an example. One of the things that worked great for us, at least, you know, when I was going up on the first push, my first duty station in the Marine Corps, I was stationed at a place called 29 Palms, California.
Uh-huh.
That is in the middle of the Mojave Desert.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, we were used to the glare, we were used to the sand, we were used to, you know, shoot, move, communicate,
mm-hmm.
you know, on uneven terrain, but we could see farther.
Yeah.
East Coast Marines, they're used to training in the jungle, in the mountains.
Yeah.
So for them, like, even the glare from the sun on the sand was difficult.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so like coming from one desert to another, for us, it was just like, you know, now we're just actually shooting to kill, not shooting, you know, blanks or shooting, you know, our paper targets. So we were used to that. But like I said, I believe East Coast Marines had a little bit of a hard time in Iraq just because they were not used to, you know, mm-hmm. training on the desert. Mm-hmm. I mean, we lived pretty much in the middle of the Mojave Desert, and that was our training background.
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely difficult for us, obviously. In the UK, we get like one day of sun a fucking year. So, going from like, I don't know, we don't even work in Fahrenheit, but I don't know, 30 degrees Fahrenheit to a fucking 120 like that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
and you have 4 days to get acclimatized before you're patrolling on the ground. You're like, fucking
it's
what?
Hard.
Yeah. But, you know, you got to do it. You got to do
hard.
It and you do it.
Suck it up and do it, man.
Yeah.
And, you know, hydrate and eat as much as you can
that's
when you
it.
Can.
And then you fucking sleep the rest.
That's it, bro. That's it. But there's no working out when you're pushing up.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
There, gym time when you're trying to get to the objective. Especially if you know that it's going to be a 3-4 day push.
Yeah.
You eat, and then you do fire watch at nighttime.
yeah. So for the listeners, fire watch is like what we call stag. So obviously it's your turn to look after the camp or the little fortified position. So everyone else sleeps and rests and recuperates while you stay up and watch, say, for an hour, 2 hours, then it's someone else's turn. But yeah, I mean, I think the worst time for firewatch / stag for me was like either the 3 till 5 a.m. That's the worst one. Trying to stay awake in that 3 till 5, even when there's two of you, it's so hard.
Especially when you know, like, after five, within half an hour or 45 minutes, the sun is going to start coming up and everybody's going to be up.
Yeah, and it's fucking hot already.
So you're literally up from 3 all the way up to the next night.
Yeah, and it's fucking hot already at fucking 6.
Another thing that it was obviously not a lot of people, unless you were on the original push, was able to experience.
Mm-hmm.
Dude, we were on a mob suit. So for the listeners that don't know, a mob suit is a jumpsuit that you put on that looks like a fly suit, but it's for chemical and biological warfare. And that shit sucks.
It's charcoal lined, isn't it?
Yes, charcoal. Charcoal is a liner, but obviously, in between, touching your skin is a layer of a material that you don't breathe. Then the charcoal, then, the outer layer is another material that, obviously mm-hmm. it's completely water and proof of anything going in and out. We did the entire push all the way up to Baghdad, and we were in a mob suit for 59 days.
How did, did people pass out?
30, yeah. I mean, it's
inevitable,
But like I said, coming from 29 Palms, California, we were used to being in shitty heat. But on day 30, we changed the mob suit that we were wearing for 30 days, stinking like a freaking baboon. we set that on fire, and then we put another one on. And there was a couple of times where, there was a scud flying on top. So we went all the way up to Mach 4. That means you got your regular combat boots, then you put the rubber boots on, rubber gloves, mask, your kit, your Kevlar. And that's how you patrol for 16 hours a day.
Fucking hell.
So that's why it's like, being a mob suit, that's no joke, man.
Yeah.
It drains every ounce of fluid you have in your body.
That's hardcore.
It drains. It got to a point where the only thing that we were put on, it was like a silky. Just to protect our freaking butt cracks and our nuts. that's pretty much it. And a silkies, and a pair of socks, because everything else you would just overheat more than what you 100%. Can handle at the time.
Like that, trying to drink water through a respirator, through the little straw.
It's hell, man. Fuck. Honestly,
it's literally like torture. It's torture. Like,
we were so frustrated that many times we were like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm gonna take this shit off. If I'm gonna die, I'm just gonna die.
Yeah.
But I'm gonna freshen up and drink water from the canteen or the Camelback. Luckily, like anything that flew over us, that our commanders called for Mach 4, it was no chemical or biological. Because I believe if that would have been the case, a lot of people would have died.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. A lot of people were just so fed up with pushing in an AAV, an amphibious assault vehicle. That vehicle is made to the size for one squad of 12 Marines. We had 19 Marines in there, plus 4 crew, all the food and water you can pack in there. I was riding on a javelin from Kuwait all the way up to Baghdad, literally sitting with a javelin next to the radio.
Yeah.
So we could only open one hatch. Because on the other side, all that freaking smoke would come in the back, and you would suffocate.
Yeah.
So I mean, so we were like literally sardines in a can in there. But you know what? It was some of the worst and some of the best times.
Yeah.
In my life, and I wouldn't change it, man.
No. Yeah, that's fucking crazy. That's crazy. I remember we flew to Kajaki because there was a massive blue on blue. I won't talk too much into the blue on blue, but we were crashed out to help with the recovery of the bodies. because we were Brigade Recce Force at the time, and we were on downtime, so we got crashed out as sort of like a reaction force to go and recover the bodies. And we landed in Kajaki, but there was no vehicles to take us from the HLS down to the ops room, what you guys call the B dock, for quick QBOs. So we all just were in a dumper truck, you know, a big truck with a big bucket on the front. So there was about 12 of us just sat in this bucket, just getting taken down this track all the way down to the ops room, and we're just like, oh my god,
what? But it was better than walking, right?
yeah, 100%, 100%. But
oh man, good times, brother. It was good times.
Crazy.
Definitely. I think that for us, after going through that experience, you know, whether it was Iraq or Afghanistan or the guys that were in Africa, I think that our generation has a lot to say to our kids and our grandkids. Hopefully our grandkids don't have to go through that, you know, but if they ever do, at least we can give them firsthand, you know, accounts of what to do and what not to do.
100%. More not what not to do than what to do.
Obviously, like, I would never want my daughter to go through what I went through, but if she, for example, if she ever decides to join the military, or if I have a son and he ever decides to join the military, you know, definitely teach him what a good NCO should do, what a good NCO would not do, and if they ever become officers, how a good officer should handle the 100%. Platoon and his guys.
Yeah.
Because we both went through the what the F moments of our lieutenants and captains. Like, what the F are they doing?
Well, it's usually the platoon sergeant tells the young officer to shut the fuck up and sit down.
When you have a good platoon sergeant. But as you know, the some are just a bunch of ass kissers that are, yes, sir, no, like, yes, sir, for everything. And so I think about it a lot. Like, if I have a son and he ever goes to the military, whether enlisted or officer, you know, I'm going to have a sit down with him. But like, listen, this is what happened to me, and this is how I felt because of this asshole, you know, because he was shiny bars, thinking he could just run a platoon without experience. You know, like, as a corporal, as a sergeant, I mean, you have a few years under your belt, and you know how things should run.
100%.
So if you ever become a leadership position, it's like, hey, listen to your NCOs. And if you're ever an officer, like, listen to your platoon sergeant. Listen to your squad leaders, because they've been there, done that.
Yeah.
You know, just because you have a college degree doesn't mean that you can run the show.
No, no.
You know, Gecko, like, you better earn it, man.
I'm concerned, a new enlisted officer, a new officer is just the same as a new private that's just joined.
A boot. That's what we call it.
That's it. A boot. A pogue and a boot.
They definitely gotta earn it before
100%.
So they can start running the platoon how it should be run.
100%. Well, bro, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Absolutely, man. Thank you for having me.
So when you appeared on Netflix, what was that all about? Because I remember it was because a friend of mine sent me a picture saying, bro, you're on Netflix. I was like, what? What are you talking about? And I looked, and there's a picture of us. So what was the deal with that? What's
So a buddy of mine, he's a film producer, you know, up in Canada. You know, obviously not gonna put his name out for OPSEC, but
sure.
You know, he's doing pretty well, and he's working with some big time people, and he wanted to do a documentary, you know, movie/documentary on the security industry, because some of his friends and clients are in the Hollywood industry.
Yeah.
So they wanted to do a documentary on, you know, like, hey, how a security team should run for, like, you know, the Hollywood people or VIP. And they had, like, people that did security for, like, Mandela, you know, the Beavers, and you know, but they didn't have anybody who actually done this type of security in places where actually security is needed.
Yeah, sure.
Not showing off like the people in Hollywood that just want to walk around with a bunch of freaking, you know, 300-pound dudes that don't even know how to put a tourniquet on, or don't even know how to, you know, shield.
Yeah.
Or just
do anything. Yeah.
Shit that you and I know.
Yeah.
You know, they just want to look big and intimidating.
Yeah.
So they asked me, one of my buddies reached out to me. He's like, hey, you know, they want to do this. Would you be interested? Just so that you can tell the part from actually operators or people who do it in places where, you know, you get 500-pound bombs blowing vehicles up.
Sure.
So I was like, sure, man. So I went up to Canada. You know, they flew me up there. They told me what was about. And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. I'm game. You know, and my buddy, you know, he was like, hey, you want to make any money? I was like, no, man, I don't need the money. Whatever. It's, you know, it's all good. And so they asked me, hey, you know, let's send us some pictures of, you know, things that you would like us to show or things that are good for you.
Yeah,
And to me, like that picture with you and I standing, you know, in the middle of nowhere with the two SF guys. You know, the guys that came to our camp to work out with us, the ODA guys. That's one of my favorite pictures ever.
Yeah, it's good. It's good.
So I was like, this one right here is definitely going up. I don't know why. I really like that picture.
Yeah, it's good.
We're standing there, all four of us. So that's how. So that's how we became Netflix famous.
Yeah. Well, that, I claim that to my fame. All the guys are like, what's your claim to fame? I was like, I've been on Netflix.
So, yeah, that's pretty much how it happened. But, no, it was good, man. I got a good feedback because, it was good because it was not about talking about killing people or shooting people or anything like that. It was about the hardships about, hey, you know, like, missions 18 hours, 16. You're hungry, you're tired. But guess what? You still got to bring the client back safely to the FOB because that's where you're getting, you know, paid to do.
Yeah, and professionally, yeah.
Exactly. You know, mortars hitting the camp. You still got to make sure that, you know, the clients living in the camp with you are safe and make sure that nobody's overrunning the camp. So there's a lot of things that, you know, a lot of people don't know, you know, that they claim to be security experts because they walk around some Hollywood famous people, you know, in their Gucci bag. And I'm like, that's not how things
network.
There's no carrying Gucci bags. It's, you know, carrying a 70-pound kid. And, you know, you're ready to run a couple miles.
With the client on your shoulders.
With the client, exactly.
Yeah.
So, but that was it, brother.
Right on, man. Right on. Well, thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for having me.
And we will definitely pop over and see you guys when we're there next year.
Absolutely, bro. Well, let me know, man. Let me know. Give me a good date, you know, in advance where you guys are planning. And
yep.
We'll definitely, you know, plan something special for you guys to come down.
Perfect. Sounds awesome. Thank you, buddy. Appreciate your time.
Absolutely.
Love you, bro. Thank you.